This is a podcast from policyreview.tv.
So that means we have a full 15 minutes now for questions. Because there's other people watching us and because we want this recorded so you can access it tomorrow, can you make sure you wait until you have a speaker in front, microphone in front of you before you ask a question? But do people have questions for our two speakers? Got one there.
I think one of my questions is that it's fantastic that palliative care are looking at bereavement services. And yet my experience in Hertfordshire is that children who aren't bereaved via a palliative illness are not receiving care. So there's going to be a huge gap, therefore, if all we're doing is looking at bereavement services within palliative care and looking at funding strands for them, but not looking across the whole spectrum of children's needs in respect of more different types of death and the needs of those children around that. And certainly currently, I think there is a huge lottery postcode around what children receives what, dependent on what's available in their locality.
Yeah. Do either of you have a response to that comment? Or?
Yeah, well, I mean, the work that we're doing is called palliative care. It's a palliative care funding review, but it is looking at, you know, all the deaths which occur in England, of which there are 500,000 every year. Some are sudden, some are frail elderly, some are children. Yeah, but we're going to come out with a funding mechanism to ensure that whatever you die from, whether it's acutely or chronically, then the services that you need, and if bereavement is part of that, there should be a mechanism for ensuring that that is funded. So I think this is an opportunity to try and get that right. And the one thing that's clear is that it shouldn't depend on where you live, whether you get the right services.
Yeah.
And I think I would echo it shouldn't depend on where you live, nor how your brother or your sister or your parent died. And certainly I know, having been part of some of the consultations, particularly one recently at the Childhood Bereavement Network, that was the point you've made was really emphasised that actually that shouldn't be a postcode lottery, as I say, for where somebody lived or why they died, that a child's bereavement needs were paramount and services should be tailored and designed around that. And I think from what the young people were telling us in their story, they appreciate a range of support and can work with and meet and find affinity with children, whatever the cause of death. They don't need it, this kind of... you can only be on this pathway because your parent or your brother or sister died from this cause.
Great. And I think you're right, there's a postcode lottery. The services are so very different across the country. And there's really two ways that we can begin to change that. One is from the top down, and it's great to have sort of high-level reviews taking place. And that phrase you used of national guidance but delivered locally, I think that's great that that's trickling down from the top. But also from the bottom up, and it's events like this where we have different people from different services here attending, but also different services joining together to actually put the event on. I think those sorts of things will help us eventually to reach more and more children that we can help. But thank you. That's a great point. Thanks.
And thank you for a really fantastic overview, and I really appreciate what you're thinking. The words that are resonating in my head, this is perhaps a question for Professor Kraft, is the dichotomy between, I think, what you described as pathological grief and routine grief. And I can quite see how we're being encouraged to think in those ways because of the funding implications behind it. And I just want to remain curious about the fact that, is it ever routine for a child who's experienced the death of a particular parent or a brother or sister? I would make an argument that we... And I know Debbie's here from Cruise as well, so it'd be interesting to... I'm torn, actually, because I'm not sure I can even live with it in adulthood, but I think it's much more of a challenge for society for the state to provide for all adults who've been bereaved. But I would like to lay a stake in the ground that we do treat children differently. I don't think it's routine at all for any child I've ever met in sort of 23 years of working with children whose parents or brothers or sisters have died, for them to feel like it's a kind of normal, regular thing for that to have happened. And I think somehow we've got to look at rather than what the funding is dictating, is what do children really want? You know, they don't want to be defined by the cause of death. They don't want to have their grief necessarily labelled as pathological. They want to go through the same door. The services have to be joined up and their needs assessed, so that some of them do need very sophisticated interventions, which are much more likely to be state-provided. But I'd just be interested to know how we can get around this language and not be forced around the kind of, especially with all the restrictions around funding, how we can make sure that children's voices remain unlabelled and their needs met.
Thanks, Ginny. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, I did exercise some hesitation in saying routine grief, because clearly it is not routine for a child to be bereaved. This is something special. It's very special for that child. But many of them, you're the experts, I'm not the expert. I mean, I've looked after children with cancer for many years, but my experience, I'm sure that of you, is that many children, with the support of their family and their extended family in their community, will get through reasonably well and be left with their good memories and no long-term problems from it. I mean, I was very interested to hear what you have said about the various things that can go wrong. And whether that is, you call that pathological grief or whatever you call it. But all children don't need psychological support. They don't need intensive help from a specialist psychologist. Most children will be able to get through with some sort of support. But I'm not in any way suggesting that it's routine, but it is something perhaps which, it must be a spectrum. And there are some who require more help than others, and some who require really state intervention, and others where society might be able to do it. But maybe I'm wrong. Tell me I'm wrong. I'm always willing to be wrong.
Julie, do you want to come back to that or not? It's an invitation.
I certainly wouldn't want to say that you're wrong in any way, and I just think it's so tempting for us to... when we talk about specialist provision from a psychologist, which tends to be NHS funded or whatever, it's just that those of us who are in particularly the charitable sector trying to organise these services, yes, they're not rocket science. I'd be the first one to say that. I don't think bringing groups of children together to deliver bereavement services is rocket science. We've had 20 really productive years of working out what their needs are, how those needs can be met. Increasingly, we're getting better research and evaluation to show how they can be delivered. The challenge for us is having the funding to deliver them. And also the challenges of we a lot of particularly teenagers don't want to engage with these services. So we have to be very active in marketing and selling them and engaging them. So I just think it's this dichotomy of thinking that happens when we think about... Because we will go down the route, I think, of beginning to assess children and having to decide whether they are a priority for an intervention, because there isn't enough services out there. So it's a very... I don't know. I can understand the logic, but what really worries me when you meet a group of kids, they don't define themselves as... I'll be talking this afternoon about a young guy who, you would definitely assume would have pathological grief, and yet he didn't need perhaps as much help as a young girl that I saw recently whose best friend died in a car accident from a very middle-class privileged background. So it's just how we're going to make the decisions about who gets what help. And maybe it's utopia, maybe it's idealistic, but wouldn't it be great if we just actually had a one-stop shop for every child whose mother, father, brother or sister who died can go through the same door, their needs can be assessed, and then the family's needs can be met appropriately. But I think that what will happen because of funding is that children will either get nothing and just have to somehow get through, or they'll go down the pathological route, which will be... more funded by the state. That's the risk, I think.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
It was nearly answered. I just wanted to ask who the advocate was going to be for the
for the family, really, in the joined up service, who was going to take responsibility for telling them what was available and how they would come to these joined up services if they needed something.
Okay.
Because too often, I'm always getting phone calls for help, and as a hospice worker, I can't always help.
Yeah.
Because they're not part of our organisation.
Okay, so how is the question about how do the family get signposted to the appropriate services?
Yeah, because it doesn't happen at the moment.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Do either of you have any wisdom?
I think signposting is a real challenge and bringing, because from what we know with postcode lotteries, services are so different in every different part of the country. Services start up and finish, and actually keeping abreast of that knowledge. I suppose there's some fundamental planks that we would really endorse at the Child Bereavement Charity. One is about support and training for the whole of the children's workforce around the needs of bereaved children, really, because the more informed the whole of the children's workforce is through their core training around those needs, then actually that they many, as we kind of hinted at, don't need specialist support. They just need a network of people who understand their needs. So it's, I think, a plea around training for the whole of the children's workforce. I think it's then clear signposting and knowing that there may be some organisations and a number of us, Crews, Winston's Wish and ourselves at the Child Bereavement Charity do have helplines which can signpost, which can direct people to information, not just national information, but certainly on our database and on the Childhood Bereavement Network database. We have 350 organisations across the UK that we can help people be signposted to. So I think it is a big challenge, but I think that it's about us all working together to try and make that as joined up as possible for the families in the middle.
Yeah, I mean, my concern about it all is to ensure that, you know, I mean, who is it within society or the professions that should be responsible for triggering or pointing people towards services? And you know, if you've got a child who dies that's been connected to a hospice, I mean, ACORNs, you know, provide fantastic ongoing services, which David will probably tell you about later on today. Ross Russell will tell you something about what happens if people die acutely in an intensive care ward. You know, you are in a system which has got bereavement services in one way or another joined up to that. But you know, it's people who die outside of those systems that concern me more than anything else. You know, whether it's an adult or a child, certainly if it's an adult, you know, who thinks about their children? They very often don't. And my contention is that probably the only person, well, schools, you know, perhaps could be given some responsibility. You know, that is, you know, all children go to school, so maybe that's where, you know, it could be picked up. Or, you know, everybody at the moment is registered with a GP in this country, and maybe the GP should be given the responsibility of saying, you know, because if somebody dies, say, you know, who is in this family, you know, let me just make sure that, you know, we point them in the right direction, even if it's just giving them a leaflet to say, these are the services which are available locally for your children, your grandchildren, or whoever. And, you know, how could we make sure the GPs do that? Well, you know, one of the things I think that we're going to have to do in the palliative care review is to have some mechanism of assessing afterwards whether this has been a good death or not, whether people got more or less what they wanted. And that's hugely difficult. I mean, if you go and have your hip done, you can have a patient satisfaction survey when you get home. Say, yeah, I had, you know, great, or I didn't have a great time. But actually trying to go to not the person that's died, but could go to the person that's died, that would be, you know, really tricky. But, you know, to go to their relatives and say, you know, how was it for your relative? That's much more difficult. Do you go immediately? Do you wait 3 months when they've forgotten about it? But maybe what we could, you know, do is to somehow build in to a GP system that, you know, have you reviewed all of the deaths in your practice, and, you know, have you actually pointed siblings in the direction of whatever it is they need? You know, three or four things, and that may be one of the... it is one of the things that we're seriously thinking about. How can we evaluate it? Because one of the things that Andrew Lansley is absolutely adamant about is that the new NHS, you know, the key thing is outcomes. He gets up every morning and chants, outcomes, outcomes, outcomes. You know, so we've got to think of some good outcomes. And, you know, what is a good outcome and how do we ensure that? You know, that's a real challenge for us.
I think that's a real challenge in the bereavement field when, and looking at some of the evidence, when some of the outcomes are actually not immediate, they're in the long-term and preventative. Actually, it's a big challenge for us in the field of outcomes and how we measure them for young people.
Great. Thank you.